Good morning. That gospel passage you just heard, I bet you never got that in Sunday school. I've just switched myself on, and this one obviously isn't going. Put it to sleep. So, as I was saying, that reading we just heard from Jesus, I bet you never got it at Sunday school. How do you explain to a five-year-old who ever comes to me and does not hate mother and father, wife and children, brothers and sisters, yes, even life itself? Heavy. I want to come to that, but not in a straight line. The question I'm going to pick up is, why does Jesus say these things? Why these hard statements? Could I have maybe the first picture? I think it's the Auckland Harbour Bridge. There we go. The coat hanger. Some of you may have remembered from your childhood when this was opened, 1959. Engineering marvel. Two lanes in either direction, the Auckland Harbour Bridge. But within 10 years, it was obvious that it had been false economy to build with four lanes. It just wasn't coping with the flow of traffic as the city grew and cars proliferated. So, again, probably from living memory, you know what the solution was. Next screen, please. Oh, we'll just clip on a few lanes on either side. The Nippon clip-on, because engineered in Japan and then attached here in New Zealand, the Nippon clip-on. So two lanes, more on either side, taking the total. Next screen, please. From four to eight lanes, as had been recommended in the 1950s to start off with. But false economy was, we'll just trim it down. One of the big strategic mistakes in Auckland town planning. But then problems came. You probably anticipate what the problems are. The structure wasn't sound. There were cracks in the welding, attaching the extra lanes to the main structure. And it's from what my reading, I had to refresh it because I first framed this message quite a while ago, but 2006 was the last assessment and response to this. So I remember many times driving over the bridge in a car thinking, I'm on the lanes that I just could fall off. And there are no trucks here. All the trucks are kept to the main structure. It has been said that the great New Zealand contribution to architecture is the lean-to. The lean-to. They're everywhere, aren't they? But this clip-on, this lean-to, this adds something to the main structure, and we'll roll with that. It's a way of thinking, and I'm not just saying it's New Zealand. It's a way of thinking. It's deep in us. We have A, and we add B. And we hope it will hold. Now, as if I wasn't hearing the Holy Spirit right this week, it got kind of practical. So a few months ago, I invested in these magnetic glasses, magnetic lenses. And I'd often have the clip-on ones that you attach. But these ones have a little magnet in, and they sit there like this. Until this week, this happened. They're no longer attaching. The little stud has come loose. Another failure of clip-on technology. This time, they can't blame the Japanese. I think it was made in Christchurch. So what am I getting at? Why are we having this little review? Here it comes. So often, God gives us something good, true, solid. And human history is a tale of adding something to it, clipping something on. But then it goes a stage further, where what's clipped on is everything. It becomes the main agenda. It holds all the attention. So I was sitting with this for a few weeks, and then this week I walked into a church in Auckland. I've been in Auckland for a few days. Could I have the next picture, please? Oh, yes. Does anyone know where this church is? It's St. Margaret's, Hillsborough. And I walked in and I was arrested. There it is. For those on Zoom, it simply reads Jesus, white letters on a black background. And it's a modern space. It has a little bit of sacramental focus with the table. And then the other sacraments of our age, the keyboard and the drums. It's sort of a visual focus in many churches when you walk in. And if you're sort of symbolically orientated like I am, it sort of takes a bit of processing. But there it is, great thumping letters, Jesus. And I've never seen that in a church before. I've never seen that in an Anglican church, you know, usually far more kind of image orientated. And what I celebrate in that, what stirs in me is bold as brass, Jesus is central. I got it. If they were to make a statement, the statement to make is Jesus is Lord. But it's gone a step beyond that. It's just Jesus. Uncomplicated, nothing connected to it, just Jesus. Now, the thing is, church has been rolling for a long time. And through the centuries, more and more has been clipped on to what should be a Jesus thing, a Jesus movement, a Jesus people, a Jesus fellowship. And it's the clip-ons that cause all the headaches. So people remember the clip-ons. They remember the extra agendas, the things that are supposed to be secondary but became primary. Some of you are preparing for our diocesan synod. You can make the connection. I waded through, I think, more than 100 pages recently. I don't find Jesus in there. It's all secondary, consequential, yada, 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 color of a toilet seat stuff. So disappointing. But here's the thing. It's us. We've been focusing in recent weeks on, open our lips and our mouth shall declare your praise. And you know, I've been banging on a bit since I've arrived in terms of what people actually talk about. Sort of coming back to New Zealand, it was like you very quickly tune into what conversations are actually all about. And they're different in different parts of the world. People's imaginations and concerns and fears are different. So people talk about different things. But this, at some level, we seem to either have a difficulty or be reluctant to talk about what's central, the main thing, Jesus. And we talk a lot about all sorts of clip-ons and secondaries. Please don't feel told off because I'm saying we talk. It's an us thing. No one has a conversation on their own. So getting back to this picture, that really spoke to me. I thought, wow. I don't know how that got there. I don't know if it was the Vicar's idea that he did in the under cover of darkness, or whether vestry or, you know, an AGM or something got to that point of deciding. So the Americans have given us a one-liner to sum all this up. Keep the main thing the main thing. You've heard that before? You're laughing, Ross. Like, they bless us with pithy one-liners, the Americans. Keep the main thing the main thing. And in church land, that is so difficult because the agendas have been built up over centuries, over centuries, over centuries. You tickled me a few weeks ago, Gay, when you said you reminded us that you went to church once with hat and gloves. People have told me that in some churches, they had to wear the right color socks. This is men. Dark blue. Particular denomination. Man, we get curious. And the reason this often happens is because we lose sight of the main thing. Jesus. Okay, so not a surprising message to hear in church. Let's get back to Jesus, what he says in today's gospel. And incidentally, I know there's a bit of kerfuffle around us, but standing for the gospel, we stand to hear Jesus. Some denominations have Bibles of red letters, you know, the red letter text. Has anyone got a red letter edition? Okay, what's that about? The words of Jesus. The words of Jesus from the Word. He is the Word. Jesus is the Word of God. In his being, in his presence. And then he speaks. I'd like to have his actions colored as well. What Jesus did, as well as what he said, because they both speak. But Protestant emphasis is on you know, sort of propositional, articulated word. So, to today's gospel passage from Luke, large crowds were traveling with him. Crowds in Luke's gospel are interesting. One of the things Jesus does is play the crowd for his own security. As long as he's with a crowd, he's safe. He chooses the moment to leave the crowd, and that's when he's arrested. But crowds also come with complications because if they don't keep the main thing the main thing, crowds very quickly see an opportunity to harness, to convert, to transfer the potential that's there into something other than what Jesus had in mind. So every now and then when he has a following, he does the exact opposite of what all the church growth gurus tell us. He drops a bomb. He's sorting them out. Are you a whole bunch of wannabes? Or are you actually hearing me and we're together in this? Like I said, Jesus says things, he does things. You need to interpret both. And in that context, he turns to them. Just imagine. To address them. Whoever does not hate Father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters, yes, even life itself cannot be my disciple. Now, a couple of things to pick up on here. First of all, Hebrew is not a nuanced language. Greek, English, we have ways of expressing the strength of a statement. In Hebrew, you either love me or you hate me. It's like that. You either love or you hate. And the essence of love is wanting and seeking the best for the other. And the sort of way Jesus promoted that was, of course, agape love, a Greek word, wanting the best for the other to the point where you sacrifice for that. You give of yourself for the betterment of the other. When I hear kia ora, that's what I hear in Maori. I hear that sentiment, that shalom, may it be good for you, may it be well. And so Jesus is saying, look, discipleship, loving me, is going to require from you a letting go, a distancing, as if you are hating your parents. Who remembers the moral majority of the 1980s? Jerry Falwell, I think. Family values. Republicans tippy toes to the White House and all that. Well, a lot of the reason that happened was because Christianity and churchianity was equated with ma, pa, and the kids. Apple pie. Wholesome family living. And even now, if you want to reach out to a community as a church, you know, run family-orientated programs, courses on enriching your marriage and reaching your teenagers and all that sort of stuff. You know what I'm talking about. Okay. What does Jesus say? So to make sense of this, you know, even life itself you're supposed to hate. Gosh, what happened to self-esteem? What he's saying is being his disciples needs to be the main thing. It needs to be that part of you that's actually like the central core of the Auckland Harbour Bridge, rooted, grounded, together. And then everything else is a clip-on or secondary. But this is your love. This is the main thing. You may have heard this many times before, or you may be hearing it first time in this way. And then he gives some examples of what this is like. You know, it's simply cost surveying. You know, you build, have a project. How much is it going to cost? He wants people to be sober about this. Some of us can get really excited and then just brush with it, and that's like the seeds that fall on ground and sprout but have no staying power. He's saying, look, being my disciple, there's a cost to it. And it's like simple analysis you do before a building project or before going to war. You count, you do the arithmetic. So none of you can become my disciple, he ends, if you do not give up all your possessions. Whoa, that could worry us. What I understand him to be saying there is in the business of becoming a disciple, you actually become a possession. You belong to Jesus. Where do we mark this? Well, it's baptism. Baptism. It's a ritual death. And for those of us who have been baptized as adults, especially in a full immersion, it is literally stepping into a grave to say, this life, I don't love it. I'm going to let go of it so I can step into the life of Jesus and live it as his disciple. And some of you may even have had the experience of doing that without the support or even the protest of your mother and father, your family, in which case it gets really kind of actual. You're choosing for Jesus against the protests of other significant people in your life. I don't know if anyone's had that. Many people from non-Christian backgrounds can relate to that very clearly. Did you ever sing the song here, I Have Decided to Follow Jesus? It's written by a man who did that. It's written about this experience. The cross before me, the world behind me, though none go with me, still I will follow. Sadhu Singh, I think was his name, wrote it in about the 1920s, an Indian convert to Christianity. So these are my reflections on this disturbing passage. And incidentally, one of the good things about being in a sort of organized church is that we read the Bible systematically. So we have a lectionary. So in 3 years' time, you'll get this passage again. And having been a preacher now for 27 years, I really benefit from the fact that it's like the old spiral curriculum we had at school. We keep going round, we come back, and it's these difficult words of Jesus that, well, could easily not be chosen to speak about in a church. Aren't that attractive? But with a lectionary, we get them every 3 years. What I think our lesson at the moment is about is learning to think and speak with the awareness that Jesus is the main thing. Jesus is the main thing. And to be a people who can chat, gossip, talk about that. In terms of mission, this is really important. Because I don't think anyone's going to walk in that door and be taken with talk about the secondaries, about the clip-ons in our life. I don't think that's going to happen. But from experience, both as someone who's talked about Jesus and someone who's listen to others talk about Jesus. God works in that. Now, why is this so difficult? Well, in times of my life, it's been really easy, and other times it's really difficult. So here's my reflection on this. most of us were raised in a time when church had a place in society. And being a Christian, well, wasn't totally misunderstood or crazy. Tio, a long time before you were born, you know, 30% of New Zealanders went to church apparently in the 1960s. It was a kind of peak. No accidents, about the same time that television rose. Television is sort of like a very early version of Zoom, analog, last century. Almost can tell Theo to see. Oh, we used to have aerials on top of our TVs, the big bunnies, the rabbit ears.
Box TV.
Okay. Your grandparents had one. That was before they got. Oh, their parents had one.
Only jokes.
Okay.
It's on its way out.
So we're going to the 1960s, the world of Hillman Humbers and Wolseleys and things like that. Here's the thing, though. Christian faith and Western society sort of aligned. And you could be a Christian, and most people, or a lot of people, had been to Sunday school and sort of had the plot, sort of understood where you're coming from, what it was about. So you didn't have to talk about the primaries. You didn't have to keep the main thing, because it was a kind of a gentle, unpressured, supporting flow. If you have children under 30, maybe even under 40, that's not their world. Under 30, it never has been. Never been in that sort of gentle flow where Christianity and civilization and how things happen have meeting points. So without that kind of gentle, assumed cultural current, you have to become more decided, and in that being more decided, more able to express, to articulate, to explain who you are, what you believe, and here's the big thing, who Jesus is. Who Jesus is. You can't assume. And your generation, at this point, I think it's more you. You're the generation who are being brought that challenge here somewhere in your 60s, 70s, and 80s. And you've got a choice. You can say either, no, it's too hard. I'll just cruise on as if it's 1980. You can do that. Just be a little churchy minority. And frankly, some churches are deciding consciously to do that, and it's just a managed decline. We'll just cruise out. Just make sure I get a Christian burial, please, and turn the lights off. Or you can recognize the season and engage the adventure. And this is where it gets really practical. If you have grandchildren, how do you talk Jesus to them? How can you do that? Now, the way I see it, what makes it so hard is the way we were taught Jesus doesn't work for our grandchildren. When I first stood up in a classroom in about 1984, there was a very observant, acerbic member of staff who said to me, you went to one of three schools in Christchurch. And I said, how do you know? He says, because of the way you teach. He was sharp. We teach the way we were taught. Unless we really do the business of reflecting, reviewing, and changing. So you can't sit your grandchildren down with a flannel board and a chalkboard and do gospel Bible stories of them. Well, not past 3 or 4 anyway. What I think people today need to hear, particularly, is the sound of the heart, the language of the heart. 1970s, the second wave of feminism hit the nail on this. Germaine Greer and associates, with a slogan, "The personal is political." Brilliant. The personal is political. And the cultural swing that was happening at that time is exactly what we are still trying to catch up with. How do you talk what's real in your heart in a way that cuts ice in a hard world? Another cultural moment where this was really seen to get rough was the relationship between our present monarch, Queen Elizabeth, and her daughter-in-law, Lady Diana Spencer. Just replay what that was all about. There are several movies made exploring that. Watch one recently, Flying. The world that Elizabeth Windsor grew up in, charged with duty, with service, and she's a believer. And the world that Diana Spencer grew up in, she's born 40 days before me. All you need is love, da, 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 and so on. Well, your grandchildren live in a more kind of, you've got to live it experience rather than bite your upper lip and do what's required. Otherwise, we'll all be talking German next year. Hope this is making sense. I'm trying to snatch things that you'll all be familiar with, but it's with us now. How do we have Jesus as the main thing in a way that someone walking in the door, drinking coffee with us, having fellowship meals, hanging out with us as we do what we do, will get? That's why, maybe that's why that hit me so. This isn't a clubhouse for a whole lot of kind of religious groupies of particular socioeconomic persuasion. Now, this is a Jesus place. And everything gets referenced to him. So when we have a question as a community, our go-to, our first mental inquiry is, what would Jesus say? Where's Jesus on this? So I think I've set something out there. I may have stirred something here. The secondaries, the clip-ons, they're not bad. But when the main thing is neglected, we have the makings of idolatry, where something other than the main thing becomes the main thing. And everything gets kind of skewed. Those of you who pray for New Zealand as a nation, who have a sense of burden for how troubled things are, everyone seems to see it. And it's not just New Zealand. The world is in a disturbed state. But the way forward, if the church is to play the role it has so often played in taking us from that disturbed, debauched, confused, conflicted mode into something that just has something of the kingdom of God about it. The way forward is when we rediscover Jesus. And the way Jesus said it was, when I am high and lifted up, I will draw all people to me. So, coming to land here. Can we turn up the volume on Jesus? Can we do that? We can do it if Jesus lives here. Otherwise, it's just blah, blah.